"'Keep going straight on,' said Elizabeth, very close to Alison's ear. "'Put your hands in your opposite sleeves. Yes, like that.' Alison did as she was told, taking one wary step at a time as if she were heading a funeral procession. The light grew dimmer and dimmer until she could no longer see the patterns in the carpet before her. Strange smells reached her nostrils, some sweet, some piercing and disorienting, the combined effect being reminiscent of a recently repainted candle shop. Walking in a straight line was taking up most of her concentration. She allowed her eyes to glaze and relived the moment in which she had glimpsed the agenda. There was the tablet, held on one side by Danvers, slim hand, wristwatch, trimmed fingernails, and on the other by Kaysen, long fingers, grubby, smelled faintly of leather and monster munch. There were precisely 27 lines of varying width in sans-serif text. She mentally cued the words of the top line at the back of her mouth. "He who approaches the hand of Merlin, the seat of power, will identify himself," boomed a male voice from up ahead, startling Alison. She had stopped walking at Elizabeth's touch, but only at this moment became aware of having done so. "The Master Apprentice," called Elizabeth, initially imitating the booming tone of the first speaker, but allowing the last syllable to tail off into a bored sigh. "The Hand of Merlin recognizes the Master Apprentice, Elizabeth Lawrence, first among the acolytes," said the first voice. "What request do you bring from the world of men?"
"The world of men requests the infallible wisdom of the Hand of Merlin in matters eldritch and ineffable," continued Elizabeth, now barely even pretending to be enthused. "I bring the scroll of untold presence that you would advise us."
Alison heard what sounded like silverware being set on the side of a plate. "Now, Miss Lawrence," said another male voice with a public school accent, "that doesn't look much like a scroll, does it?"
"Item one," replied Elizabeth, touching Alison in the back as if pulling the string of a talking doll.
"Item one," stated Alison, drawing out the vowel sounds slightly, in a manner she hoped sounded mysterious and dreamlike, "evidence of Shoggoths in the Lake District."
"Miss Lawrence," interrupted the first, harsher voice, "are we to take it that the scroll of untold presence is not in physical evidence this morn?"
"The scroll is entirely intact within the memory of this acolyte," assured Elizabeth. "I made the decision that an agenda held only within the mind of a devotee would represent less of a security risk."
"Most irregular. Oh, come on, Jack," said the second voice, or it might have been another. Every single member of the hand seemed to be an elderly man with an upper-class accent. "I think it's rather jolly. You can't say it isn't fitting."
"Can you vouch for the accuracy of this acolyte's memory?" asked the booming first voice humorlessly.
"Without reservation," said Elizabeth.
Alison wondered how much her reputation had preceded her. Adam had made a few phone calls during the drive down, but had stopped once they were on the motorway, after a couple of hair-raising close calls.
"Very well, have your girl proceed."
"Item one," repeated Alison, as Elizabeth's fingertips poked her spine again. "Evidence of Shoggoths in the Lake District, reported by agents in and around Keswick."
"Wasn't this brought up last time?"
said what Alison was pretty sure was a new voice, which possessed the jowly ring of the hugely corpulent.
"Yes, 2 days ago," said Elizabeth. "In your wisdom you agreed to dispatch our local agent in that area to investigate a reported stench consistent with Shoggoths. He has now confirmed Shoggoth presence and is following their trail."
"Oh, yes, I should do that," said one of the many voices.
"The hand will speak,"
intoned the first voice, which seemed to be the chairman or spokesperson.
"Our agent will continue his pursuit of the Hellspawn until they are caught and exterminated. The hand has spoken."
"Next," whispered Elizabeth to Alison.
"Item two," read Alison, putting even more of a lilt on the mystery voice. "Suspected manifestations of magical infusions in humans."
"Three today," said Elizabeth.
Alison heard paper being unfolded.
"Mysterious fires in a primary school in Southwark, an individual advertising a faith-healing practice in Boreham Wood, and a scorch mark shaped like a human hand has appeared on a statue of Rupert Brooke in Rugby."
I have local agents lined up to take care of the last two, and Agent Collins can handle Southwark.
Fine, said at least three men in unison. The hand will speak, said the chairman, now starting to sound a little bored himself. The agents mentioned will be dispatched as you see fit. If tainted ones are found, they will be taken to the monastery. The hand has spoken.
Excuse me, Miss Lawrence, said a new voice.
This was the oldest and poshest of the lot, and spoke with a breathless, earnest, but slightly baffled tone that reminded Alison of members of the royal family trying to converse with civilians.
Do you know if my ideas for the monastery school are on the agenda today? I made a special point of reminding my son about it.
From the rest of the hand there came a short chorus of groans, sighs, and tongue clicks, not quite subtle enough to be ignored.
"Well, I just think it's important," protested the speaker. "It's so very important that we reach these young people, and there have been many points of concern."
"Only the Swordkeeper himself and this acolyte currently know the contents of the agenda, sir," said Elizabeth diplomatically.
"Let's just get through it, Danvers," sighed another member of the hand. "If it's not there, you can take it up with your boy."
"All right," said Danvers Senior. "I do think it's so very important."
"Item 3, said Alison, as Elizabeth poked her again. "Werewasps dealt with."
"Cason and Hesketh report that they successfully exterminated the entire hive," said Elizabeth. "I would, however, like to bring together a few of our local agents around Lincolnshire Wolds to oversee evidence clean-up."
"Yes, to be expected with those two," muttered someone. "The hand will speak," said the chairman. "Our agents will remove evidence of the presence of tainted ones, be they hostile or within our employ."
There was an uneasy tone creeping into the last part.
"The hand has spoken."
"Item 4, said Alison eagerly. "Reassessment of monastery school practice, fill in some bullshit to keep the old fart happy."
Alison only passed her own words when she felt the stunned silence holding on with a death grip to every cubic inch of stuffy air in the room.
"Perhaps we'll leave it there for today," said Elizabeth tightly.
7. Alison sat on a stool in front of Elizabeth Lawrence's desk, half curled up in a private little cube of hot embarrassment. A while ago, Richard Danvers had walked past her into the hand's chamber, acknowledging her with a perfunctory nod of reassurance as he went. 10 minutes later, after a muffled symphony of angry, jabbering voices, he had come out again and flashed her a scowl so terrible that she had quickly feigned interest in her shoes. Shortly afterwards, the thuds of Elizabeth's walking cane rhythmically hitting the stone floor emerged from the gloom, followed by Elizabeth herself. She limped to the desk and daintily sat down without a word. The moment she was settled, Alison leaned forward and clutched the edge of the desk with both hands. "Miss Lawrence, I'm so sorry," she said hastily. "It was what it said on the page, and I didn't realize—"
Elizabeth silenced her with a dismissive flap of a hand.
"It wasn't your fault, Miss Arkin. Richard should have kept his editorializing to himself, and I should have given you more directions. I can at least credit your ability to follow instructions to the letter."
Elizabeth's habit of constantly talking in a slightly judgmental monotone made it virtually impossible to tell when she was being sarcastic. Alison decided that apologizing again was the safest response.
"I am really sorry." "Put it behind you."
Elizabeth leaned back comfortably and gathered her hands in her lap.
"We should discuss your new employment. Mr. Hesketh didn't have the chance to fully brief you on the Ministry's workings."
Alison came very close to asking Elizabeth how she could possibly have known that.
"You must have questions."
"Yes, lots," said Alison immediately.
"Good. Feel free to start at the top."
The many questions she had assembled jostled for position on Alison's tongue, until she opted to interpret Elizabeth's suggestion literally and voiced the most recent one. "Are the Hand of Merlin meetings always like that?"
Elizabeth raised an eyebrow. "Not before today, no."
"I mean, is it always just you listing the things you've already decided to do and the Hand agreeing with it all?" The older woman straightened up and pinned Alison in place with a glare.
"'I don't like what you're implying, Miss Arkin. "'The Hand of Merlin have been sanctioned to oversee dealings with the occult since Elizabethan times. "'It's true that in recent decades they have concerned themselves more with broad policy suggestions "'and left the fine details to the apprentices, "'but they are as vital and integral a part of the Ministry of Occultism "'as the Queen herself is to the governing of the nation.' "'Alison nodded rapidly. "'I see. I get it.' "'Was that your only question?' "'Alison bit her lip. "'Miss Lawrence, do you mind if I ask if you have a magic power?' "'Elizabeth hesitated. "'Her hand began to fidget subtly with the head of her walking cane. "'No, I don't. "'What about Mr. Danvers? "'Or anyone in the Hand of Merlin?' "'Mr. Danvers used to run a publishing company. "'His qualifications lie in management skills. "'The hand's talents are—' "'More subtle. Why do you ask?' "'I thought most of the people here would have magic powers. "'I heard most people go from the school to the ministry.' "'Not usually to the core ministry,' said Elizabeth. "'We have some tainted ones in the scroll for research purposes, "'but the exceptional graduates from the monastery "'are mostly given part-time freelance work as local agents. "'Adam Hesketh and Victor Kaysen of the Sword "'are the only permanent staff members that carry the taint.' Alison's growing cheer and not being as much of a fish out of water as she had thought was undercut by a new feeling of unease. "'Tainted ones?' "'The jargon's confusing you,' said Elizabeth, softening. "'The ministry headquarters has three divisions, the sword, the scroll, and the hand. The sword consists of agents and field operations, the scroll, our research and intelligence wing, and the hand is the command centre that manages the two.' "'Have you given any thought to which area would best suit your abilities?' "'Well, Elizabeth hadn't stopped talking, because I have something to propose, if you aren't certain.' "'Okay.' Elizabeth leaned forward, placing her clasped hands just below her mouth. "'Most of the sword operatives work in groups of two or three,' she said conspiratorially. "'Except for one. Agent Diablery is currently working alone, and I have decided he will be assigned an assistant. "'And you want that to be me?' "'Yes, Diablery is resistant to working with partners, but he will be more open to the idea of a subordinate. "'Report to the Sword briefing room after lunch, and you'll meet him there. "'Follow his instructions. "'Come to me if you have any concerns.' "'She turned to her computer to signal the end of the conversation. "'Unconsciously, Alison had already risen. "'Thank you so much, Miss Lawrence. "'I promise to do the job as best I can.' Only after these sentiments had hurried from her mouth did her mind begin to consider the prospect. This will be working in the field, right? Actual missions? Elizabeth glanced up. It will. By all means, come back to me if you have trouble meeting the challenge, but this is the best possible path your career could take at this point. Really? Yes, anything we can do to keep you out of the ministry bunker for the next few weeks will minimize your chances of being murdered by Mr. Danvers. 8. Alison opted to eat lunch in a sandwich shop on street level. The ministry had its own dining hall, but after the morning's events she felt it probably wasn't the best time to start networking. Besides, Adam's anecdotes on the drive down had preemptively soured her to the food. As she sat at a red and white checked table digesting half a baguette, and non-institutional food entered her system, her mood began to tentatively improve. It was a nice day, to the point that the residents and workers of central London could occasionally be glimpsed briefly permitting themselves a smile. Under a blue sky rather than low-hanging stone, the prospect of her new job was more appealing than ever. At the monastery, Alison had memorized countless written and spoken accounts of magical creatures, and that had been fascinating enough, but the thought of filling her memory with sights and sounds of magic in practice, in the real world, filled her with excitement to the tips of her fingers. Agent Arkin, of the Ministry of Occultism. She knew it would possibly be dangerous, were-wasps certainly sounded dangerous, but she had had enough safety in her life. Safety had always meant sitting where her mother told her to sit, and quietly watching whatever repeats were on television. Safety hadn't left her with much, danger had to be at least worth a try. Besides, she thought, as she made her way back to Westminster Abbey, Elizabeth wouldn't send her on dangerous missions, not right away. She was smart, Alison could tell. And smart people don't send teenage girls to fight monsters. Alison re-entered the secret bunker and made her way to the briefing room. She already knew the way. Earlier, when Danvers had been hurriedly escorting her to the meeting,
she had glimpsed a floor plan on a wall for a tiny fraction of a second. Relaxed, bustling conversations streamed out as she pushed the door open. The room beyond reminded her of the classrooms at the monastery, but now the tables were packed with grown adults, sitting comfortably, checking personal notes and talking among themselves. The exceptions were Adam and Victor, seated near the back. Victor was slouched in disinterest, while Adam was straight-backed and eager, like the teacher's pet waiting for the first precious opportunity to tattle. Adam beckoned vaguely as she entered, so Alison glided down the narrow aisle between the rows of desks and took a seat directly behind the pair. Not a single agent so much as glanced at her, or paused their private whispered conversations with their partners. The moment she was settled, Victor Kaysen leaned back on two of his chair legs. "Did you really say what you said to Danvers' dad this morning?" he said, out of the corner of his mouth but not in the least bit quiet. Alison reddened and attempted to retract her head into her jacket. That was all the confirmation Victor needed. His happy grin stretched across his skull, his facial muscles struggling with the unfamiliar action. "Is it true you called him a miserable old bastard without even the common decency to hurry up and die?" "Of course she didn't, Victor," said Adam, looking ahead in an "I'm totally not part of this conversation" kind of way. "That's what you said," she said. "No, I didn't. I said she called him a clueless, doddering scroat who needs to stop poking his nose into real people problems." "Oh, whatever. I heard 5 different versions over lunch break anyway." "I didn't say any of that," hissed Alison, flustered. "So what did you say?" asked Victor. "I just said he was an old fart." She suddenly became aware that the rest of the conversation in the room had mysteriously died down, so she gathered herself and went down to the lowest whisper she could manage. "Mr. Danvers wrote it. I didn't know. It just slipped out." One of Victor's eyebrows rocketed upwards. "So what you're saying is that you let an old fart slip out? Yeah, I've been there." Adam leaned close to him confrontationally. "You're harassing her now, Victor," he warned. Victor displayed his hands, almost losing his balance before slamming one foot onto the top of his desk. "No, I'm not. That was good-natured ribbing. It shows we're at ease with each other. What, you think I fancy her?" He placed a hand between his mouth and Alison as if to talk privately, then spoke at full volume. "I only go out with girls that aren't dictaphones on legs."
"What are you talking about?" said Adam. "You've never gone out with any girls. Neither of us have."
"Shut up, shush!" Victor turned to Alison and tried to look casual. "The old lady chew you out?"
"No, she said it wasn't my fault." This time, Victor did lose his balance, slamming his shoulders against Alison's desk and shoving it into her midsection. He kicked his legs wildly to shift his weight back onto all 4 legs of the chair, then scooted it awkwardly back into place, under the disapproving looks of the rest of the agents.
"She what?"
"She said it wasn't my fault. Said it showed I was good at following instructions." She gave an unruffled little smile. Victor was silent for a moment, his jaw swaying in the breeze like a pub sign.
"We are talking about the same person here, right? The dread pirate Pegleg?"
"Keep it down," whispered Adam urgently. "She knows we started that. She gave me a job, as an assistant field agent," concluded Alison.
Both Adam and Victor's expressions froze, Adam with eyes wide and lips parted, not daring to hope, and Victor with staring disgust.
"Assisting us?" asked Adam.
"No, Agent Diablerie."
Victor's face didn't look like it was used to grinning much, but it was a 10-year veteran of smiles compared to how strange it looked when he laughed.
All the air flew from his lungs in a single guffaw, and he had to rest his forehead on the desk. Adam's eyes were on stalks, even while his voice was level.
"I could talk to her if you want, move you to someone else."
"Oh, I actually believed it for a second," said Victor, wiping his eyes. "Pegleg pirate being nice. The depressing thing is, this is probably the best day I've had all year."
"What?" said Alison. "What's so funny about Agent Diablerie?"
"He's a villain," said Victor, before descending into snickers again.
"Yeah," said Adam. "That's pretty much the only word for it. He's a villain."
The door opened, and Richard Danvers entered, silencing all conversation, when he dropped a brand new tablet onto the lectern with a thunderous clap. Alison tried her best to tunnel inside her jacket again, but amid the small ocean of shirts and ties, it only made her more noticeable.
"What are you doing here?" asked Danvers, with the voice of a man trapped in hell, bumping into his usual tormentor outside work hours.
"I'm supposed to work with Agent Diablerie," said Alison, as quickly as she could.
"She's the doctor's new glamorous assistant," said Victor, manfully keeping a perfectly straight face.
"What?" said Danvers.
He consulted his tablet, and the corner of his mouth made a sudden dash to the side before he got it under control.
"Oh, so she is. Well, the good doctor doesn't seem to be present, but I'm sure..."
The door opened a crack, with the quick, furtive motion of someone attempting to go unnoticed. A metal sphere, not much larger than a marble, rolled into the room and came to rest a few feet from the door. Danvers put a hand on a hip and rolled his eyes. The sphere exploded into copious clouds of red smoke, building quickly until it filled the surrounding area from floor to ceiling, at which point there came the sound of the door hastily opening and closing. As the smoke dissipated, it coalesced into a dark figure, at least 7 feet tall, with broad, looming shoulders and long, slender legs. The effect was swiftly spoiled by Richard Danvers, who sprayed the contents of a handheld fire extinguisher at the pellet.
"You've been warned about this, Doctor," he said, with more exhaustion than anger. "We don't want the carpet catching fire again."
The last of the red smoke faded, and only Dr. Diablerie remained. He was a thin man, wearing jet-black evening dress, complete with a red-lined waist-length cloak, white gloves, and walking cane with misshapen silver head. His height was not as impressive as his silhouette and implied, as it was significantly augmented by his absurd silk-top hat. His face seemed to be unusually small, but that may have been because it was staring out from the gap between his hat, his absurdly high collar, and his tightly knotted scarf. He was pale and ratty, and the sneer he was wearing made his thin moustache even more steeply curved than it was by default.
"Trifle not with forces you do not understand, son of Danvers," he declared, for his deep voice seemed capable only of declaring, never saying. "Dr. Diablerie has been summoned to this realm. What trivia requires my dark expertise?"
"Oh, I'm glad you asked me that," said Danvers, returning to his lectern. "We have a new number one priority, courtesy of the Hand. We need someone to inspect the secondary school and provide a full report on how it's running. I can think of no one better qualified among all the agents of the sword."
Diablerie's hand flew up, covering the lower half of his face with his cloak. "Dr. Diablerie is no mere enforcer of your petty bureaucracy."
"Well, he's not a doctor either, but he still insists on being called one."
Diablerie and Danvers stared each other down, the mad, blazing gimlet glare facing off against bored, half-lidded professionalism. Finally, the doctor lowered the cloak from his face. "Very well. I, Diablerie, will see to this trivial matter." His cloak barely had time to fall back down to waist level before he threw it over his face again. "But know this. The arcane power of Diablerie runs deep, and thirsts always to be tested against the forces of evil. You would be wise not to trifle."
"Sorry, I seem to be trifling an awful lot this afternoon," said Danvers.
"Oh, I almost forgot," he lied. "This is Alison Arkin. She's going to be your assistant from now on."
Alison was already on her feet, drawn up almost against her will by wary fascination.
"Hello, nice to meet you, Doctor," she said, out of habit.
Diablerie's sneer deepened by several notches. His hand tightened around the head of his cane, and his other hand flew to his hip with a flourish, fluttering his cape.
"What nonsense is this? Diablerie is no childminder."
"Orders from the Master Apprentice herself," said Danvers, waving his tablet with the relevant email open. "So if you have an objection, take it up with her."
Diablerie's eyes narrowed like those of a cornered beast, and his cloak flew up over his face again. "Girl," he barked, slightly muffled, "you will meet me outside Barnstable train station tomorrow at noon, and no later. So says your new master, Diablerie."
He made a strange movement behind his cloak with his free hand, and then another pellet hit the floor, quickly obscuring his form in more clouds of red smoke.
"Wait," called Alison. "How do I get to Barnstable?"
"It's not complicated," said Danvers, as he irritably sorted through his notes. "I think you take the Penzance train from Euston and change at Yeoford."
"Silence, fool!" said Diablerie, his voice coming from somewhere near the door. "You have to change at Exeter St. David's now!"
Alison heard the door open. "Heed the esoteric wisdom of Diablery, Exeter Saint David's!" His voice grew faint, and the door slammed shut, sending the remaining tendrils of smoke into a swirl. 9. Alison spent the night on a bunk in one of the disused barracks in the deepest section of the catacombs. No one had told her where to go, but no one had stopped her either. Danvers, Hesketh, Kaysen, and every other normal person had gone home at 5 p.m, leaving only a minority of unspeaking monks to do the cleaning. Sleep came easily enough after the sound of vacuuming carpets and sanding walls had died down. When Alison awoke just after 7, she opted to head to Euston Station straight away, before the agent started arriving again. Danvers had provided her with a government credit card, and she used it to buy the cheapest ticket available. She settled into a cramped window seat and pretended to be concentrating fiercely on the countryside as she replayed the events of the previous day over and over again in her head, trying to determine the precise point at which she had botched it completely beyond salvage. Barnstable train station was one of the many traditional brick stations that dotted the land, surrounded by flat, open countryside that was only slightly let down by the inevitable industrial-sized Tesco. Alison stepped out into the station car park at around 11:30, raising one hand to protect her eyes from the sun, and glanced around for something to sit on while she waited for noon. "Girl!" boomed a familiar voice from behind her. She spun on her heel. Diablery was leaning, arms folded, on the Barnstable station sign. He was wearing exactly the same clothes as yesterday, his cloak gathered tightly around him so he resembled a sleeping bat turned upside down. "Doctor," she said, clasping her hands behind her back, "I just wanted to say I'm really looking forward to working with you and, She faltered as his withering stare bore into her. "I promise to do my best to..." He waited, unblinking, until she had stammered her way to silence. "Can you drive, girl?" "You mean like a car?" said Alison, caught off guard. Diablery didn't dignify her question with a reply. "Yes, I have a license." Her mother had let her take lessons after she turned 17, on the proviso that Alison pay for them herself and understand that the heat death of the universe would occur before she would be allowed to borrow the family car. "Then drive," said Diablery, unfolding a skinny arm towards a nearby vehicle. Alison had expected something like a jet-black hearse, or some Victorian automobile one step above horse-drawn technology, but Diablery's car turned out to be a surprisingly modern four-seater convertible, although it was jet-black, that much was inevitable. Diablery glided fluidly into the back seat, and Alison wondered if he had chosen an open-top car because it meant he wouldn't have to remove his hat. Obediently, Alison climbed into the driver's seat. It was a far cry from the beaten-up Metro in which she had learned to drive. The interior was covered entirely in bone-white leather and what looked like imitation marble. The clutch pedal was shaped like a crow's foot, and there was a carved ivory skull on the gear lever, but the basic functionality seemed to be unchanged. "I really like your car," she tried. Another few seconds of silent, blistering contempt passed before Diablery deigned to respond. "Stow your facile pleasantries. We delve now into the world beyond the gossamer threads you so innocently think of as normalcy. You are unprepared." He steepled his gloved fingers. "Our destination lurks, pre-programmed, within the sat-nav." There was a touchscreen embedded in the dashboard, shaped like an ancient church window. Alison prodded it, and a synthesized voice that sounded not dissimilar to Diablery's own directed her north. "Your name," said Diablery. In the rearview mirror, Alison saw him put one hand to his temple and extend the other towards her, fingers half-pointing, half-clawed. "No, say nothing. I can read it in the eddies of your aura. I see the letter A, and an N."
I'm pretty sure Mr. Danvers said my name when he introduced—
"Natalie," said Diablery, displaying his hands mystically. "I divine your name to be Natalie." "Alison." "Son! Natalison! Alison, of course! Do not be afeard. The dark powers that are but playthings in my grasp grant me sight most uncanny."
"It's very impressive, Doctor."
"Silence! I must gather my energies for the challenges ahead."
He arranged his fingers crookedly and held his hands either side of his head.
"Do not interrupt. If the spirits are disturbed, the results could be disastrous."
For the next 20 minutes, Diablerie emitted a series of noises from the back of his throat, rolling his eyes back into his head and keeping his hands perfectly still. He started with the traditional oms, drawing them out for up to 30 seconds each as his mouth formed circles of every size and shape. Then he raised in pitch and started making ee sounds, quickly transitioning to widdly 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 widdly. Alison kept her eyes on the road as her new mentor went through his repertoire of vowels. She struggled to maintain interest in the countryside, having seen it all when she and Adam had come through it in the opposite direction, so instead she considered the prospect of returning to the school. She thought of the shame she had felt when Adam had clumsily dropped the bomb. She thought of Rana and Craig Turbrook, and then out of nowhere she thought of Elizabeth's words, tainted ones. Diablerie abruptly stopped making sounds, and Alison glanced at the rearview mirror just in time to see him holding a hip flask to his mouth, which he hurriedly returned to his pocket, before putting his hands into vaguely mystical positions again.
"You have questions you wish me to answer," he said, opening one eye.
"Yes?" garbled Alison, her instincts clashing violently.
"It is only natural to be intrigued by Diablerie," he replied, steepling his hands again. "You are a blank canvas across which the hidden world has yet to splatter its essence." "Very well," he sat bolt upright, very nearly losing his hat to air currents. "You shall enjoy the enormous privilege of a boon in return for your paltry oath of service. I will answer 3 questions. You may ask 1 additional question each time you show promise."
3 questions? He rolled his eyes.
"Yes. 2 questions remain."
"Oh, sorry. I didn't think we'd started." Diablerie glared at her intensely.
"Diablerie does not word his pacts carelessly," he boomed. "Careless wording is the most vital tool in the demon trickster's arsenal. Seal a vicious, starving were-trout in a poorly phrased rune circle and try telling it you didn't think you'd started before your very soul is sucked out through your nose. What is your 2nd question?
"What?" Alison came very close to asking what a were-trout was, but bit off the sentence at the last moment. On reflection, it seemed self-explanatory anyway. "Sorry. Okay. I've got a question now. What does tainted ones mean?" Diablerie used his cloak to cover the lower half of his face again.
"Heed now the bottomless arcane wisdom of Diablerie," he said, turning some impressive eyebrow gymnastics to emphasize the words. "Tainted ones are ones that are tainted. Heed now this 2nd piece of esoteric wisdom. Diablerie is considering withdrawing your boon and waiting for an acolyte with harder questions to come along."
"I heard someone at the Ministry call magic users tainted ones," said Alison, carefully checking her statement to make sure it couldn't be interpreted as a question. He sniffed.
"Indeed, for they carry the taint of magic. Does that satisfy, or art thou in need of a dictionary?"
"But doesn't it, I mean, they make it sound like a bad thing." Diablerie's permanent sneer took on a slightly baffled subtext.
"They carry the taint of the ethereal realm. Their very bodies are infused with the essence of the ancient ones in aid of their sinister otherworldly agenda. What would you have us call them, the sugar plum fairies of Cuddletown? By all the sauces, when will it be enough for you, ministry fools? Was it not concession enough to employ the wretched things, to start teaching them instead of burning them at the stake?"
Are you for real?" asked Alison, before she could stop herself. An eyebrow came up.
"Is that your 3rd question?
"No, Her sentence disintegrated into fragments of words.
"Speak!" ordered Diablerie.
"I'm sorry, I'm just really confused." Tears formed in Alison's eyes. "I just want to do the best job I can, but I don't know what you want from me."
She met his gaze in the rearview mirror, jaw quivering, and didn't detect an ounce of sympathy.
She sucked in a deep, noisy breath through the nose. I keep thinking this has got to be some kind of test. Like I'm supposed to call you out to pass it, and then you can start being serious.
Diablerie's shoulders shuddered, and his eyes narrowed. I assure you, girl, that I am as real as the consequences of reading Richard Danvers' unguarded comments to his father's face.
Alison shrank, fighting off the urge to burst into further tears.
Right.
She gripped the steering wheel tighter and concentrated on the road. This was her opportunity, she reminded herself. Elizabeth Lawrence had given her this chance for redemption, and she would not be impressed if Alison demanded a different assignment just because her new boss was an insane silent movie villain and she was afraid of being lashed to some railroad tracks. Shortly, they found themselves on the lonely and less travelled section of road that Alison recognised as the way to the monastery school. She was keeping an eye on the treetops, waiting for the first sight of the grand old building where she had lived for 6 months, when the sat-nav unexpectedly chirruped and directed her to make a turn. Dutifully she did so, and was almost immediately on an unfamiliar road. The trees became denser, the canopy thickening until they blocked most of the sunlight. She checked the sat-nav. There was the monastery school, clearly indicated with a pentagram-shaped map marker, but their actual destination was marked as another mile east.
I thought we were going to the school, said Alison.
Diablerie is no longer bound by the compact to answer your questions, girl, said Diablerie, bored.
He was leaning back with his top hat tilted in front of his eyes.
That was more of a statement.
Argue not niceties with a master spellcrafter. It was a statement with a distinctly inquisitive aura.
Without warning, the road transitioned from tarmac to dry dirt that had been churned up by the tires of many heavy vehicles. Diablerie's car was the exact opposite of appropriate for off-road driving, and he was forced to maintain a mystic gesture about his temples to hold his hat in place. The trees thinned, and the dirt road sloped downwards into a large bowl-shaped clearing. In the centre of the crater was a cluster of concrete buildings that made up for their distinct lack of windows, with a bounty of severe straight lines and right angles. Between them was a huge circular courtyard, walled off with 10 feet of cement and coils of razor wire. Alison parked the car between two black armoured buses, near a brick sign bearing the words Blackmore Young Offenders Institute in harsh serif letters.
"Doctor, this isn't the school I was at," she said quietly, staring up at the flat, grey, front-facing wall of the reception building.
"Of course not," sneered Diablerie, who was already out of the car, although Alison hadn't seen him move or heard the car door open. "This is the secondary school. This is where you would have been taken had you ever manifested the taint."
Alison recalled the one time she had seen someone in Brother Burling's class demonstrate magical ability. Chris Lewis, a short boy of 16, had managed to make all the ants in his focusing tray march in perfect circles and figure eights. Brother Burling had showered him with praise and led him gently from the room, then returned 20 minutes later alone. Lewis had never showed up in class again. Alison had been concentrating entirely on being a diligent student, and had never, until now, wondered where he had gone. Diablerie glided over to the forbidding steel double doors and wrapped the top of his cane against them, creating a sonorous clang that must have echoed through the entire building. The door swiftly opened with a reproachful metallic creak. Diablerie made his signature move, flinging his cloak about his face.
"Cower now! Dr. Diablerie has answered the summons. This household will surrender to the whims of the Ministry of Occultism."
A young monk was standing at the door in the usual robe and tattoos, as well as a black gun belt around his waist with a taser pistol. His hand unconsciously groped for it as Diablerie spoke.
Yes, he replied. "We were told to expect someone. Brother Trevors will see you."
Without lowering his cloak, or indeed moving his upper body at all, Diablerie slid into the lobby.
"Hello, nice to meet you, I'm Alison," said Alison in one rapid cluster of words as she brushed past the monk.
He frowned, opened his mouth, looked to Diablerie, hesitated, then closed his mouth. The lobby was as severe as the exterior. The floor was bare cement, and two spiral staircases led up floor after floor of steel gantries and heavy forbidding doors. A second monk was rapidly descending one of the staircases,
his shoes making a lively percussion on the metal steps. "Hello, hello, hello, hello," he began, before he'd even reached ground level. "Nice to meet you. I'm Brother Trevor's." Alison renewed her smile. "Hello, nice to meet you. I'm—"
"Curtail your inane discourse!" boomed Diablerie, his voice echoing nicely throughout the hall, in a way that even he had to take a moment to appreciate. "Diablerie comes to cast judgment upon this house of dread. Tarry not with your paltry demonstration."
Trevor's was a large, rounded man with a red face and a Cockney accent, clearly accustomed to being the most dominant personality in the room, so having to apply the emergency brake to his introduction left him discombobulated.
"Rightio, then," he said, awkwardly withdrawing the hand he had extended to shake. "Let's head on over to my office through the exercise yard, and you can see how the kiddywinks are doing on the way."
He politely held open another set of double doors, and Diablerie and Alison passed through into the enclosed yard. From within it seemed even bigger than it had from outside. It contained hundreds of young men and women, arranged into perfect rings that stretched all the way around the circular space. Each one was wearing a grey jumpsuit, and marching slowly around the perimeter in perfect time. The air was filled with the collective scraping of hundreds of uncomfortable shoes stirring the sandy ground. In the centre of the ring was a raised wooden platform, surrounded by a smaller ring of monks, all with one hand resting on the tasers on their belts. Upon the platform stood a bored monk holding a loudhailer. "Left, right, left, right, left, right," he droned. "Listen to my voice. It is the only voice speaking. Stop." There was a deafening crunch as the entire company halted. "Jump up and down three times." Three more crunches. "That was my voice. I am the only one talking. Continue. Left, right." Trevor's led Diablerie and Alison around the perimeter wall, keeping at least 6 feet of distance between them and the outer ring of marching inmates.
"Yeah, we're up to 206 pupils," said Trevor's. "You're in luck. We've got all of them out here today. No one's in solitary for once."
Alison couldn't stop looking at the body language of the pupils. It was as uniform as the clothing they wore. Their faces were tilted toward the ground, wearing dreamy expressions of sadness. Their shoulders drooped, as if their arms had grown too heavy to lift. She did, however, catch one or two of them taking confused sidelong looks at Diablerie as they passed.
"Sorry, what's going on here?" asked Alison, after mulling over how to begin for several minutes.
"You what, miss?" said Trevor's.
"My assistant is new. She has only borne witness to the primary school," explained Diablerie.
"Ah, say no more. That old Dumbledore ho-ho-ho young wizards thing? That's what we call the carrot phase. You're looking at the stick now."
Alison was agape.
"So it's a lie? What do you mean, a lie?"
Trevor's paused in his stride and turned to face her. "The nice school is still nice. The nice school has to be nice. You're more likely to spark off a magic power if you're comfy and relaxed and encouraged. Once it has been sparked, that's when you need to bring in the discipline."
"Stop," said the monk with the loudhailer. "Turn around twice. I am talking again. Obey only my voice."
"Now, it would be a lie if the people at the nice school told them they'll be getting hot cocoa and buns for their whole education," said Trevor's, resuming the walk towards the fire door. "But they don't. It's not our fault if anyone assumes that, is it?"
Alison cast another look around the exercise yard before following the two men into the next building. She thought of looking for Chris Lewis, but it was hopeless. The pupils had different genders, body types, and hairstyles, but the universal shadow of despair made them completely interchangeable. As Alison looked over the crowd, a new revelation crept into her mind. In another sweeping look, she had confirmed it.
"Girl!" barked Diablerie, who was holding the door open for her with the end of his cane. "Daydream about hairstyles after our duty is concluded."
"Doctor," she hurriedly dashed to within conspiratorial whispering distance, which caused Diablerie to raise his cloak again defensively.
"There's only 204.
"Mr. Trevor said all the pupils were out here, didn't he? All 206?
"There's only 204.
"Isn't there?" Diablerie peered at the marching rows of youths.
"Could it be that you miscounted?"
"That I... what?
Miscounted? Calculated falsely?"
Alison looked over her shoulder, brow furrowing.
Sorry, I don't understand. There's 204. I'm looking at them now. That's just how many there are.
Diablerie gave her the sort of look that he himself normally attracted.
I see. We shall keep this to ourselves, for now.
The two of them followed Trevor's through what appeared to be one of the dormitories, a long, narrow room with two rows of militaristic metal-framed bunk beds, each with a mattress the depth of a piece of thick-sliced bread. Alison thought of the plush wooden beds from the two-to-a-room dormitories in the monastery, and felt sick. Trevor's office adjoined the dormitory, and was itself more of a sleeping than a work area. The desk was tidy and clean, while the cot in the corner was well used, the sheets rumpled and peeling from the mattress. Behind the desk was a large, high-backed office chair, the seat a full foot higher than those of the two hard plastic chairs that had been provided for visitors. Trevor's made an unsubtle beeline for the big chair and began to hunt through the desk drawers.
So, is there anything in particular you wanted to inspect, or...
Diablerie took two strides into the centre of the room and struck a dramatic pose, flinging out his splayed palms and standing with legs far enough apart to admit a fat Shetland pony.
"Silence!" he boomed.
He pressed the first two fingers of one hand to his temple and grimaced.
"The arcane spirits bring a message. They sense guilt. In this very room, burning hotly in an oven of secrets."
He aimed the pointed finger of his free hand squarely at Trevor's, who was leaning back in his chair so hard that the backrest mechanism was clicking like a Geiger counter.
Yes, it all becomes clear, said Diablerie, narrowing his eyes. Something dominates your thoughts, Trevor's. Your struggle to suppress it only makes it clearer to my sight. A presence? No, an absence. More than one. Two people. Two students?
Sweat was pouring from Trevor's now. It was channeled by his double chin into a single line that dripped down the front of his throat.
But we only just... How could you possibly...
Diablerie's sight is all-encompassing. You are not dealing with magical whelps now. Diablerie was keeping Trevor's pinned with his fiercest gaze. Alison wondered if this was partly to avoid having to look at her.
Who has escaped?
Trevor's stared at his own belly miserably.
There were two missing from roll call this morning. I've got men still searching the buildings. That's why we have the rest of them out there now.
The names of the missing, said Diablerie.
He finally broke his gaze to clutch his forehead again and stare at the ceiling fan.
The spirits form. They form the letter D. No, C?
Trevor's had produced some loose-leaf files from his topmost desk drawer. Aaron and Jessica Weatherby.
B. The letter before C, of course, it's clear now. B, as in weather B. And I sense a bond. They are brother and sister, are they not?
Yes, admitted Trevor's, spilling pieces of paper from the files. They're local, very local. Live with their parents in a little village just south of here. Bratton Fleming, that was it.
He was reading from some kind of entry form.
They probably got help from outside. That's what we're thinking.
Alison fingered the two photographs that had spilled out onto the desk and pulled them closer. Both subjects wore identical, startled expressions against a background the same shade of institutional blue-green that Alison had seen on most of the secondary school's interior walls. The sister, Jessica, was a dumpy girl with thick plastic glasses and black hair that came down to her double chin. Aaron, meanwhile, was quite good-looking in a shaggy-haired, messy-bearded Game of Thrones kind of way. His photo certainly made him look pale and miserable enough for the part.
"And you haven't yet sent men to their home?" demanded Diablerie, fluttering his cloak indignantly, bobbing onto tiptoe to enhance the effect.
"Well, we're still hoping that they haven't left the grounds."
"Hoping?" stormed Diablerie.
He loomed over Trevor's so hard that the office chair's backrest finally gave in and snapped explosively, sending Trevor's tumbling backwards in a shower of plastic splinters.
"Hope, that most destructive of mortal vices. Come, girl, we will investigate the village ourselves. Gods only know what hideousness those tainted ones are scheming even as we speak."
10. Jess sent a message at 15:48 p.m. Jess.
"Hey, Guess who escaped from prison?
XX Reva XX.
Jess, what happened? Last I heard from you, you were heading off to that really great government school.
Yeah, it turned out it wasn't that great. Things got really fascist after a while. So Aaron and me escaped and we just got back home.
And the first thing you had to do after your daring escape was talk to someone on the internet.
Well, Mum and Dad are gone, so... Also, we might technically be on the run now, so shh.
Should you even be online? They can probably trace you.
No, I'll just delete my browser history when I'm done.
I think it's more complicated than that now. I think you need to have a proxy or something like that.
They probably haven't even noticed we're gone. There were loads of kids at that school. We just have to lie low. Oh, I forgot to mention we have magic powers now.
Wow, you really haven't grasped the basics of lying low, have you?
11.
If the Lake District was, as Mike Badger's father had declared, Britain's tit, then the Peak District was the strange lumpy birthmark in the middle of her torso. It was there that Mike and David Badger found themselves, after several exhaustive hours pursuing the path of drying Shoggoth slime through the countryside. Mike was lying prone in long grass at the top of a shallow hill not far from the village of Edale, peering through binoculars with his thermos flask companionably at his side. "Looks like the slimy boogers finally stopped for a rest," he muttered. On the bottom of the long slope, on the shores of a picturesque reservoir, the Shoggoths had gathered. At this distance, it was impossible to differentiate individuals, but going by volume alone, Mike was prepared to swear that there were at least 100. They were huddled together in a huge, disorganized blob, 1,000 shades of swampy brown, providing the much larger ellipse of the lake with a filthy little companion.
"God only knows what'll happen to the locals if them things start piddling in the water," he commented.
David was sitting upright about 6 feet back, huffing sulkily because the battery on his phone had run out.
"I'm really hungry," he said. "This is technically child abuse."
"We are witnessing the biggest group of shoggies that have ever been seen in this plane of existence," said Mike patiently. "There'll be history books written about us. Children of the future will be writing essays about how Davy Badger sat on his arse and moaned about being hungry the whole time."
"No, they won't. The government'll hush it up again."
"Aye, well, not if we can't sort this out now. Ministry can't hush up now if they go on the rampage in a big town. Bloody miracle they haven't yet."
Privately, this was something that was weighing on Mike's mind. The trail had been sticking to wild countryside and poorly tended farmland, giving every town, village and major road a wide berth. One could almost suppose that the Shoggoths were deliberately trying to go unnoticed, which was behaviour far too sophisticated for a mindless flesh-eating blob from space. Still, he had found them now, so all he needed to think about was how to cull the herd.
"Dad, I'm really hungry, I'm serious,"
insisted David, switching to a more plaintive tone. Mike sighed.
"All right, I have to go back to the car anyway. If I bring back the scotch eggs we bought, will you keep an eye on the shoggies while I'm gone?"
"Fine,"
muttered David, which was the response he used for everything from grudging consent to wholehearted enthusiastic support. He dropped himself onto the patch of flattened grass Mike had left and held up the binoculars with one hand, supporting his chin with the other. He tried not to look impressed by the sheer size of the Shoggoth convention. Mike made his way back down the hill toward the patch of muddy gravel that some enterprising landowner had half-heartedly set aside as a car park. Leisurely, he cracked open his shotgun and inspected the 2 loaded salt shells. He'd have 2 shogs dead if his aim was on. Then there'd only be another 98-odd to deal with. He mentally catalogued the contents of his car boot and considered his options for improvised explosives. In a forested path halfway to the car, another human being emerged from the brush, and he and Mike both halted, mutually surprised. The newcomer was a scrawny, bedraggled young man in spectacles, a rumpled button-down shirt and extremely impractical shoes, and he was carrying 2 fully loaded garbage bags over his shoulders.
"Oh," he stammered as he took in Mike. "Oh, I didn't think that anyone else was...
"Wouldn't go that way, mate,"
said Mike, pointing behind him with his shotgun.
"All bunch of slam monsters. Ministry of Occultism business."
"Ministry of what?"
"Secret government division that sorts out monsters and that."
Mike had had the principles behind the relaxed approach to secrecy explained to him by his ministry handlers, but had never fully grasped the concept.
"Really?" said the skinny man interestedly, fidgeting with the knots of his garbage bags.
"So you're going to kill them all?"
"Aye, couple of salt shells will do the trick. Don't worry, everything's under control. Your tax is at work."
Mike snapped his shotgun open and closed in demonstration. The other man stared at the gun, not moving.
"Have you always killed them, every time you've seen one?"
"Aye, of course. What are you doing out here, anyway?"
The young man met his gaze with a start, then looked to his garbage bags guiltily.
"Me? Oh, I was just, going to dump some rubbish in the reservoir."
"I thought so."
Mike nodded towards a vaguely path-like clearing in the undergrowth.
"Might want to hold out for the next one."
"Thanks, I'll, do that."
He raised his arms high and gingerly pushed through the bushes, trying not to let the bags get snagged. He strolled in the direction Mike had indicated as slowly as he could, nonchalantly glancing over his shoulder, until he saw that Mike had disappeared from view. Then he turned on his heel with a crunch of twigs and sprinted toward the Shoggoths. Meanwhile, Mike reached the car park, pulled open the unlocked boot of his Range Rover, and inspected the contents. He and David had picked up a couple of sacks of rock salt from a farm supplier on the way, which he immediately pulled out and let fall into the dirt. He could certainly manufacture some impromptu salt shells from the normal shells he had, but every second would count after the initial attack, and he didn't want to be caught reloading. Instead, he grabbed a plastic Morrison's bag loaded with homemade pipe bombs. He always had plenty, because making them was a hobby he picked up to help calm himself down whenever he argued with the wife. He also pocketed a screwdriver set. He'd have to unscrew each bomb's casing and fill all the available space with salt. Then he closed the boot, retrieved the little paper packet of Scotch eggs from the front seat, and made his way back to the hill, carrying the pipe bomb bag in one hand, his shotgun in the other, and the two salt bags under his armpits.
"Hey up," he said, when David was back in view.
The boy was lying on his back, using the binoculars to inspect the clouds, and looked up just in time to catch the flung bag of Scotch eggs with his chest.
"Let me know if you want salt with them," said Mike, cheerfully dumping the two paper sacks at his feet.
David glared, then went back to distastefully inspect the Scotch eggs. Mike dropped to his knees and carefully crawled back up to the top of the rise to take up the binoculars. The Shoggoths were gone from the banks of the reservoir. Not a single one remained. The only signs of their presence were the usual trail of wetness, indicating that they had continued the journey south, and the shredded remains of two large garbage bags.
"I thought I told you to watch 'em," he snapped.
"I did," protested David, mouthful.
"They went off that way."
12. "Brother and sister," thought Diablerie aloud, as he sat in the back seat of his ridiculous car, smoothing down his moustache with his fingertips. "The taint is not passed through blood. Strange coincidence for a brother and sister to both possess one."
He attempted to meet Alison's gaze in the rearview mirror, to impress her with another mysterious look, but Alison was very deliberately keeping her eyes on the road. Her lips were pressed tightly enough together that she could have cracked a walnut between them.
"Something ails you," said Diablerie.
It wasn't a question.
"No, it doesn't," mumbled Alison, in as small a voice as possible.
"I sense the desire for a claim, for credit." He touched his forehead.
"You are offended that your discovery of the missing two went unacknowledged. You are pricked by your troublesome mortal pride."
Alison frowned at him in confusion.
No, it was... "Do not forget, girl, we are not partners."
He leaned back and flicked a hand dismissively.
"You are my assistant. All you should require is the knowledge that you are assisting, which you are. And you shall have a reward greater than any word of empty praise from a glorified jailer."
"What?"
"Another question, which Diablerie is honour-bound to answer truthfully. So ask."
She let a deep breath in and out.
"So we're really going to bring the Weatherbys back to that place?"
Diablerie rolled his eyes.
"Girl, I am in tune with all of the universe's most sinister vibrations. I hold before you the key to the darkest mysteries that have plagued mankind since the dawn of civilization. Please ask me a hard one."
"Next time.
The answer is, yes, we are. Now drive!"
Alison did so in silence for all of 2 seconds. "I'm not saying I don't agree with, you know, the principle. I'm just saying, from an outside perspective, it kind of looks like we're throwing people in prison just because..."
"Just because they have a chance of accidentally sparking a fiery magical conflagration with their mind," interjected Diablerie. "You know nothing."